Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/chapters. There you'll find over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Welcome to Chapters, the podcast where we hear the stories of readers' lives through the books that have meant the most to them. I'm Mary Mahoney, and today I'm talking with Matt Blackburn. Matt works as a research analyst for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and lives in Massachusetts. More importantly for this podcast, he's a lifelong reader. On this episode, we'll hear about the books that have defined his life so far, from Walden, Dune, the works of J.G. Ballard, and beyond. This is Matt's story. I'd love to start by asking, maybe if you could just sort of reflect on your earliest memories of reading.
I don't really remember it myself, but I was told by, I've been told by my mom that I started reading at a pretty young age. And I think, when I was really little, I think we sort of did it in tandem at first. Like a lot of kids start out, like she would read to me a lot, from kids' books and stuff. And that was a lot of it was probably kind of the typical kids, some of the typical kids' books for people around my age. A lot of Dr. Seuss, Where the Wild Things Are was one of my favorites when I was. Yeah. And the Spike Jonze movie was pretty good too. I like that. I don't know if you
saw the movie version.
It's pretty good. Like I think for a book that's hard to make into a movie like that, I think it was pretty good. But I also loved the book called Goodnight Moon. So those would be some of the really early ones that I remember. And then there's kind of weird offhand things. Really like to memorize things when I was little, and we had this book. It was like a giant encyclopedia of tools, woodworking tools, you know, like things like that. And for whatever reason, I was just fascinated by them and memorized a lot of this book and would talk to people about
the tools in this book
without actually knowing anything about their application or things like that.
Whose book was that?
So I think it was given to me by my uncle, who is a woodworker. So it may have come from that, or it may have come from a suggestion that he made. You know, when I was little, we would go and visit him in Boston, and he, I think I was always really enamored with what he did and the tools. So I would just memorize those. And then I also like to memorize dinosaurs and rocks, you know, different books like that.
And how old are you when this is happening?
Age ranges would probably be anywhere between like three to six, seven.
And you're memorizing whole books of woodworking tools and dinosaurs. And I mean, what do you think made, like, what kind of kid were you? Like, what kind of kid were you that you're off memorizing things like this, books that you're looking at?
I don't know. It's pretty hard to self-categorize, and especially sort of retrospectively as a kid. I think I was a weird kid, definitely. I was very, I would take a lot of things around the house and set up these like fantasy worlds and scenarios, some of which would intersperse movies that I had seen, or maybe, you know, action hero characters that I liked, but it never went directly along with the plots of any of these things or in any way. But, I would also, just collect random electronics from around the house that we didn't use anymore and set up kind of like, I don't remember even what I thought they were. I think they were like secret science labs or spaceships or something out of all this junk.
But the reason I asked was because it doesn't, I wouldn't say that it sounded like you were a weird kid. It just seemed to me like when you were memorizing things and setting up these scenarios, like you were someone who had a really broad imagination, even at such a young age. And I guess such a curiosity, because I think of a lot of little kids, when they are curious, they want to know a lot of different things, and you can really memorize things, not more easily when you're a child, but it seems like you can be obsessive as a child and like look at a book over and over again and learn things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it may not be true for everyone, but when you're younger, you can be a lot more easily captivated by things, I think, and keep a focus on those things, which maybe was why I was so enamored with some of those things and so focused on a lot of those things. So,
So were your parents readers? I mean, you mentioned your mom was reading to you and with you. Were your parents readers?
Yeah, definitely. My mom was she was a high school English teacher. Before I was born, she had switched over to freelance writing by the time I was born, and then did that throughout my entire childhood, and then went to work writing for a financial company or something when I was older. But yeah, she was huge, huge book fan. That was always a really big part of my life when I was a kid. And she, before I was born, they lived in DC, and she taught high school English in Maryland. So I definitely always had that, that environment when, growing up. So.
And where did you grow up? Not DC?
No, I moved around quite a bit. But I was born in Houston, Texas. I lived there until I was about 6 or 7. I moved. I believe it was sometime around second grade, if that's the right age. I'm not good with particular ages. And then we moved to a really tiny, like, industrial refinery town east of Houston, and lived there for about 2 or 3 years, and then moved to Los Angeles, California. When I was starting, or it was about midway through fifth grade. And then I lived in Los Angeles through the beginning of high school. The beginning of high school, we moved to Denver. And then lived in Denver, finished freshman and sophomore year of high school, and then moved to back to a suburb of Houston to finish out high school. So,
wow, kind a lot of traveling.
Itinerant, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but presumably, yeah, definitely different places. But presumably, books are one of the constants that you're bringing with you all of these different places.
It was, I think they were definitely a big part of what I did when I would move to a new place and before I kind of got situated there and really became comfortable. You know, there was always that period of time where you're just kind of hanging out by yourself a lot, which never bothered me that much. But I always, I was usually always really engaged in reading and things like that. So.
So how old were you then when you started reading on your own?
Young, probably like 5, 6, maybe. And I was always, and before that it was probably picture books and things like that. But, you know, it evolved into, you know, kids books and things like that. And I pretty quickly got into, comic books as well, but not comics like action comic books. I was sort of into that, like a lot of kids are, but more, books like Calvin and Hobbes, and especially the Farce. I think, in terms of books that were like hugely influential on my development as a kid, the first side was probably a big part of that, which
so can you describe what that is for people who haven't had a chance to read it? And then
So the Far Side was a comic series done by Gary Larson. And I don't even know if it ever ran in newspapers or anything, but it was always in these books, and they were single panel cartoons. so they weren't really serial or anything. Each one stood on its own. And they always tended to portray normal, what would be normal things, but in an absurd way. And I always thought that was really funny. Like the one of the ones that immediately comes to mind is the one where there's a family of cows driving in like a station wagon, driving by a pasture that's filled with children, and the cows are yelling like blah 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 at the kids or something. Or so I think the Far Side was a really funny take and kind of an absurdist take on everyday life for a lot of people. And there were a lot of biology jokes interspersed in that too, I think. So, yeah.
So what were the first books that you remember thinking, you know, stumbling on as a young reader that you thought, these books really speak to me, whether you found them at a library or your parents gave them to you or whatever it was?
Right. It would probably be some of the earliest ones I remember were books that we read in elementary school. One story in particular, well, there's really two that stand out as I think about them. And one was this book called Maniac McGee. I don't know if you remember that or ever read that in elementary school, but it was by Jerry Spinelli. Maniac McGee. And it's funny because I remember it being really impactful, but outside of it being about a kid who runs a lot and is sort of an outcast in his school and his community, I don't remember that many specifics about it, but I do remember that I loved that book a lot.
Yeah. Why do you think can you remember at all why it meant so much to you, or you just remember liking it?
I remember liking it. Part of it may have been the, he was sort of, you know, he was a character that, operated on his own a lot. You know, he was sort of, I think in the book he was presented as sort of an alienated character, which is not really like how I felt when I would move around. I never felt alienated. I just felt new, you know? But maybe there may have been that aspect of it that I related to, but I thought it was also just kind of a, I remember just liking the story. But I don't remember. I probably should have gone back and looked up like a plot synopsis before doing this. But
no, don't worry about it.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I do remember those aspects of it. But another book that I remember thinking was really profound, and I think also I don't remember what grade we read this in, but it was definitely in elementary school. It was the book Flowers for Algernon, which I think. Mm-hmm. A lot of people probably read in elementary school at some point, and I just thought it was a really powerful story to me. I thought it was really, you know, kind of a potent lesson in sort of humanity and how people relate with each other. Did you ever read Flowers for Algernon?
I did. Okay. Yeah, I read it in school, which is I think how a lot of people may have found that book, but. You know, can you remember why that book meant so much to you at that time, or what it was like to read it in school? Or
yeah, I think it was one of the first books that I remember making me feel sort of a deeper sense of empathy or compassion for a character in a novel. It's one of the first books I remember having that feeling. Of a deeper sense of connection, or you sort of like you understand the story beyond just the plot itself. You know, it's more like you take it as sort of a metaphor for a deeper meaning of what was going on with. Was a character main character's name Charlie, I think?
I can't remember.
Again, it's been a long time.
But thinking about, it's interesting too, just to think about trying to remember books that you read when you were younger, yeah, and what you remember and what you've sort of chosen or not chosen to forget.
Right.
And sometimes what you remember isn't even accurate for what the book was actually. I've misremembered books all the time that I've claimed are really important to me.
Right.
And yet when I look them up, I've got the plot totally wrong or whatever it is. But then it's interesting to think about, okay, well, why have I remembered this?
Yeah.
So.
And I very well could be doing that right now.
No. I'm just saying, you know. Yeah.
And another.
So.
Oh, I was gonna, the one other series that I remembered was Goosebumps. I really liked the R.L. Stine Goosebumps series.
Yeah.
They were like, you know, they were really prevalent at every Scholastic book fair that was in schools.
Yeah. Did you just like them because they were sort of creepy and strange, or was this like an early entry into sci-fi for you?
Maybe. I mean, it could have been, but I don't think any of those stories had sort of the depth that some of the other, that some sci-fi does, like certainly not all, but so, you know, Goosebumps were just like they were really fun suspense stories for kids made to scare you when you're little. So,
yeah.
Yeah, but I do remember liking that and the book series Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. Do you remember those?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so there were probably a few of those that actually really scared me. Like I would, you know, kept me up at night or like maybe
me too. I was, oh god, I'm so easily scared. Yeah. That I couldn't allow myself to even go there. I knew enough to pull myself back and say I can't handle this. I'm taking a step back. My brothers read all of them, though, and then ended up telling me about them. But, I mean, it's hard to imagine being scared by a book because you can put a book down at any time and sort of remove the thing that's scaring you. And yet really good scary books keep drawing you back in. And I remember that being a particular series that all of my friends or people at school just kept rereading and kept obsessing over these kind of stories.
Right. And it was the kind of thing where you know you're going to scare yourself and maybe put yourself in the state of abject terror, but you do it anyway. Like that's how I did it every time. I would turn out all the lights in my room and just have a flashlight and be like, I know what I'm going to do to myself. I'm just not going to sleep at all.
And it becomes, well, it's also like you're reading it with other kids in school or your friends and they sort of, you're sort of goading one another. Like, I bet you won't, you can't handle reading this book. You know, and then you sort of take it on and do it. And then in my case, anyway, I couldn't handle reading that book. But yeah, I mean, are you reading these books with other people like in school or is this something that you're just sort of like doing on your own?
The Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark was definitely on my own. I don't think that was ever something that was read as a class or anything. And I don't remember it discussing it among friends, but I do remember it seemed like a book series that everyone had, you know?
Mm-hmm. So after these scary books, where do you go next in your life as a reader? How old are you about this time?
So this would probably be through late elementary into maybe early middle school. And then in middle school, they start to introduce, I think that's when I started to be introduced to books that were a little, it had a little bit more substance, you know, and maybe, you know, more complicated plots, more what we, I don't know, if you went to school in the U.S., you probably would have been exposed to is, you know, the quote unquote classics. But, like I remember reading Animal Farm, in middle school, and my mom is also a big George Orwell fan. So I think, you know, that was something that, when we were reading it, she was really excited we were reading it, and I kind of had her there to stuff you wouldn't pick up as like a seventh grader in terms of the, you know, the symbolic value of the book, even as it's talked about in class, you know, maybe some of the historical parallels were discussed as in depth as they were when I would get home and talk with my mom about Animal Farm or.
That's kind of cool because when you think about it, you know, your teen years are for some people a time when you're sort of trying to distance yourself from your parents or you're sort of saying like, you know, I'm going to read my own books or I'm doing my own thing. And then here you have this like really cool opportunity to like bond with your mom about Animal Farm, of all things.
Yeah, and I think that was always there, like that connection. I certainly was, like, had a lot of the teen angst and weirdness too. So it was definitely, it didn't, unfortunately, our connection through books didn't, you know, manage to put that off entirely. But yeah, so I think in high school, I also got really into Ken Kesey, which some of that exposure came from my mom too, because she was a big fan of the book One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And so I got into reading Ken Kesey stuff in high school. And I think that getting into that kind of introduced me into that part of that sort of genre that is kind of the, I don't know if you'd call it like, it's after the, definitely after the Lost Generation, but, you know, it was like the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test and Tom Wolfe and stuff like that. Much of which I don't know how much I really got in high school, you know, like how much, as I've read a couple of those books subsequently, you know, after college and things like that. And to revisit them is really cool because you, in usually revisiting books, you realize how much you didn't get.
Yeah.
Maybe if it's something you read when you're younger.
So. Yeah. So what's a book that you're reading, a kind of, it sounds like a lot of counterculture type stuff. And why do you think that that's appealing to you when you're in high school?
I think it's certainly like spoke to me in high school just because of, I found it interesting in different contexts, like from a, with the Orwell example, from the historical standpoint and the parallels and, you know, the sort of like political happenings and what sort of, situations that it was depicting through that story and kind of similar things with, Arthur Miller and the Crucible and books like that. But then it was also, I think I was definitely, very influenced by general countercultural stuff in high school. I was really into, you know, punk and things that I think you sort of gravitate toward things that make you think twice about more than just what's going on every day.
So, I mean, that's what I'm curious about is sort of like, it seems like if you're reading The Crucible and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, that would seem to either solicit or reflect a kind of skepticism in you that you might have of other things like authority or in politics or whatever that you're rejecting. I mean, punk music certainly is about this,
right,
you know, in a big way.
Right.
So is that what you were thinking about in that time? Like, is that,
I think so. Yeah.
Accurate?
I think it generally informed most of the way. Yeah. That my sort of worldview, and it wasn't like, it wasn't a rejection of everything or so much as you said, sort of it heightened a sense of skepticism and also a curiosity, like just a curiosity to look more into things than what was just presented in immediate context. So I think,
and you said, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no. I was going to say, I think that's some of the impetus behind sort of veering off into those kinds of books and that kind of writing and things. I was just really enjoying that stuff.
Well, I'm curious about when you're saying that you revisited some of those books later, whether it was Tom Wolfe books or I'm not really sure which ones they were, but, you know, did you find that you were reading a completely different book because you had changed? You know, what do you remember from that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. You know, especially the longer the stretch of time between reading books, the more I was a very different person after college than I was in high school and, you know, subsequently. You definitely gain a sense of sort of perspective and a greater understanding of in some cases where the authors were coming from, but also like you have a better sense of of meaning in things, I think, or at least I did. I can't really generalize, of course, but one of the Ken Kesey books that I can think of that's a big example of that would be this book. It's like a colossal book called Sometimes It's a Great Notion. And it's a book like you would have to commit to, and you probably have to really like Ken Kesey to read it. It's kind of, I think it's kind of one of those books like Infinite Jest or, one of those books that everybody lauds as a great book, but like when you actually dig into it, it's pretty dense and like you have to commit to it. But there was a lot I didn't get about the plot structure of that book when I read it in high school, and sort of what I think kind of the meaning that was conveyed through characters and their situations that I did get, you know, when I read it in my mid to late 20s, in times like that.
So the difference for you is like on comprehension, level of comprehension, maybe not. Is it also a difference of sympathy? Like, do you sympathize with different characters? Do you, is your judgment of the book different?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, the sympathy with characters expands. And I think your general sense of, whereas, reading these things in high school, I probably was really attracted more than anything else to the sort of, question everything element of it, and the inherent skepticism in a lot of these things. Reading it later, you still get that out of it, but at the same time, you understand the deeper complexities of what the authors were saying about the lives of these characters, about what their interactions with other characters in the book actually mean. And I think, when I was a teenager and high school, there was a lot of that I probably didn't pick up on the same level, through, who knows, lack of experience more than anything else, and lack of perspective probably, that you just sort of gain with time.
So when is the next shift in your life as a reader that you remember, like a significant book or an author or a genre or something that was important to you?
I don't know that it would be a shift so much as a parallel that went along with some of this stuff, but also, I think in high school, I also got really into, some of the American Transcendental authors. And I think a lot of that influence came from my mom as well, because she's a huge Thoreau and Emerson fan. And so I think I was attracted to a lot of things about their writings, and then all of the sort of that sort of school that came about through that, through American Transcendentalists. And I was just really attracted to the idea of a sort of reversion into a simpler state, but in a way that I guess that's really one of the main things that appealed to me, was the notion of a reversion to a simpler state, as a means of finding yourself or getting a better understanding or calming down, certain anxieties that you have, it's sort of a way of turning inward and introspection. And I think that was probably the first type of writing that exposed me to that, and that way of thinking. And then there's the obvious connection to nature too, which, depending on where I lived, that was more significant in some places than others. Like, it was really, in Denver, it was great because you live by the Rocky Mountains and it's really pretty. Whereas, like, if you live in a city like Houston, not so much. There's not as much of a chance, and the weather doesn't lend itself to a lot of outdoor escapism.
But is that something, were you someone who romanticized or wanted to connect with Thoreau to a sense of Walden Pond, to going off somewhere and sort of communing with nature? Was that an appealing idea to you at that time.
Yeah, it very much was. It still kind of is. Like, my wife and I go hiking all the time, like on the weekends, and it's still, I mean, I do think there is something innately natural about that to people, and to most people, that, you know, there is just a sense of reconnection that people can have with doing that.
For our chapter's listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. If you visit audible.com and sign up for a free 30-day trial, you can download an audiobook for free. Why not check out some of the books Matt mentions on today's episode? Try Walden by Henry David Thoreau, which should take just over 11 hours to listen to. Just enough time to ponder the question, would Thoreau have allowed audiobooks at Walden Pond? In Walden, Thoreau writes, "I find it wholesome to be alone the greater part of the time. To be in company, even with the best, is soon wearisome and dissipating. I love to be alone. I never found the companion that was so companionable as solitude." Download your Audible free trial today and enjoy some solitude with an audiobook of your choice. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/chapters. Again, that's audibletrial.com/chapters for your free audiobook. Now, let's get back to the show.
But yeah, it definitely, that was, I think those were sort of the things that, the American Transcendentalists were sort of the first to, kind of open my eyes in any sort of a coherent way, to that as a philosophy versus just like, oh, I'm just going to go outside and walk around in the woods and not really think. It was a way to think more deeply about it and sort of get something more out of it that I really hadn't been exposed to that much before. Yeah. And I think through that, I don't know if that was like the impetus to get into some of the more Eastern, philosophical texts, but that's something else that I really liked and looked into, especially books like the Tao Te Ching and things like that. That I don't subscribe to any philosophy or religion or anything like that. But I did, you know, I think there, I get something. I did find something in those kinds of writings that was sort of introduced to me by Emerson and Thoreau and authors like that.
And now you're living in Massachusetts, right?
Yes. Very close to Walden, actually.
Have you gone to Walden Pond, and has that changed? What did that mean to you to actually go to this place that you'd read about?
This is going to sound really funny. This is going to sound kind of a dumb way to put it, but it was really cool. It's very pretty. It doesn't, you know, in the way.
So explain it, maybe describe it for people who have not been, or have not had the chance.
So Walden, you know, if it's something you read, if you read Walden and you've really invested a lot of yourself in the book, or you've sort of romanticized it with a lot of profound meaning, I think it's easy to have the tendency to sort of expect more than what it actually is when you get there. Because it's still very pretty. And it's depending on when you're there, it can also be really crowded. Like, people go swimming and have barbecues and like stereos and everything there, like on the banks of the river or on the banks of the pond. So, I mean, depending on when you're there, it can actually be like really loud and kind of annoying. And so during those, really the same tranquility and like meditative experience that you might be seeking from Walden, but you can go at other times, like especially during the fall, and it's really cool. Like it is very, very serene in a lot of, in a lot of respects. And you can still, there's the foundation of Thoreau's cabin is still there. so you can see it. And it really is just kind of like some old stone pillars. Like there's really not much else, but it has, you know, it has a plaque explaining that that's where he lived. And it's interesting to think about it considering the time. And you know, obviously this was like long before cars and anything. It was pretty far removed from Boston. You know, it's easy to get there now. You know, there's a train that runs not far from there, and you can also just it's like a, you know, 15-20 minute drive if the traffic's not too bad from the city. But to go out there at the time he did was to go out pretty far. I mean, you know, to really isolate yourself from the chaos and the sort of just claustrophobia of the city, which I think is what he was escaping in a lot of ways, or that's what he sought to escape anyway.
Yeah, I know sometimes literary tourism doesn't always live up to the hype. You know, when you actually go to a space that you've read about and it means so much, you get there and it's kind of like, okay, you know, what is this? But but I guess it did live up to it for you, huh?
Yeah, for the most part, it was pretty cool. My mom had different impressions of it because I think she... So I think she had gone there several times when she was younger and had remembered it as something more than maybe what she, the last time she saw it, because the last time she saw it, it was one of those days where there were just tons of people and like some super loud dad rock station was just blaring like, over like whoever was barbecuing. She was like, yeah, it really just was not what I wanted it to be this time around.
Yeah. I mean, my guess is, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, I think a lot of it depends on when you're there and who's, like, how crowded it is when you're actually there. And a lot of that, that's probably true of visiting anywhere, though. Like, anywhere that you've romanticized as being a place with a lot of gravity or something. Like, you probably, a lot of it has to do with, like, the crowd that's there at the time that you're there. So.
True. And dad rock doesn't really help any situation for the most part.
No, there's really nothing transcendental about, like, blasting like Aerosmith or whatever. It's like it's not quite as tranquil.
So what else is going on in that time period, or what comes next for you? You're reading Eastern philosophies, you're reading counterculture works, you're reading transcendentalists, like you're all over the place and you're on a journey, it seems like spiritual, philosophical, what have you. Where do you go next?
I think I sort of really, like in later high school, started to really veer toward science fiction. And so nerds really argue about this, but I thought just for the sake of like making it clear from the outset, I've always been more sort of like the science fiction that is based generally in like science has always appealed to me more than just like the pure fantasy stuff. And I do kind of differentiate the two. Certainly wouldn't get in an argument about it with anyone, but yeah, I've always been much more attracted to the sort of near future dystopia or space-ish kind of themes, to like the realm of within the realm of human possibility given technological parameters or something.
Okay.
More so that than like the dragons and like and swords and stuff. Yeah.
I feel like you're throwing shade right now, Matt, and we might hear from some listeners who are into the dragon and sword type of thing. But
hey, and that is totally fine. Everybody is of course entitled to their opinion on that. And I really enjoyed the Lord of the Rings trilogy and some of those books, but it's
it's okay. This is a safe space. Right. You can believe whatever you want to believe.
Those just never appealed to me in the same way that other sci-fi did, I guess.
What are you into? The stuff that's within human possibility, if science and technology complied, what kinds of things are you reading?
So with that, it would probably be stuff like Arthur Clarke, who wrote like 2001 Space Odyssey was Arthur. That's probably one of the things he's best known for. But a lot of Arthur Clarke stuff dealt with, and I would say probably Isaac Asimov as well. Like they took things that were within the realm of possibility, given what was understood about physics and things like that at the time, to sort of bring that into concepts of like intergalactic travel or time travel. So, I was always really enamored with that stuff because I just thought it was really cool. But then also stuff that had very sort of allegorical stories, like Dune was one of my favorites.
Yeah, that's a big favorite for people on this show. So can you talk about Dune a little bit and what it is for people who haven't read it?
I can talk about Dune for hours. Dune is a very long book, and it's actually a series of books, but the original Dune by Frank Herbert is, I'm going to try and give like the high up view so we don't get bogged down with details, but it's the story of a, what I guess you could consider a, almost a royal family, an aristocratic family in the future who move from a planet called Caladan to a planet called Arrakis. And the universe as it's presented in the book is kind of ruled by this governing body of ruling houses. And this the story centers on the House Atreides, which is the house that moves to the planet Arrakis. And Arrakis is a desert planet, and it is it has previously been occupied by this really awful family called the Harkonnens, and they are this really like monstrous, exploitive, oppressive family that have basically subjugated all of the people of Arrakis, who are called the Fremen, and the desert people, and they're the ones in the movies with the blue eyes, and they've. These people and their entire planet have been exploited for what in the book it's generally just called the spice in the book and in the movies, and the spice is what enables sort of interstellar travel within, you know, it allows travel across galaxies during this time, and the spice is controlled by this sort of ominous, opaque coalition called the Shipping Guild. But anyway, the spice can only be obtained on planet Arrakis, and it is from these giant worms that die and decompose, and you know, it's basically used as the fuel to get people from place to place. So to me, when I first read Dune, I read it as an allegory for sort of global conflict over oil, as we've seen it, you know, since the turn of the 19th century, really. And I kind of read the book as maybe an allegory for that. I don't know if that was Frank Herbert's intention, but I think some of the parallels seem clear. Because the book goes on, it talks about a desert uprising where one of the House Atreides, the leader of the House Atreides, Paul Atreides, leads the Fremen people to a revolt against the Harkonnen family, and they sort of reclaim the planet as their own. And it turns into, it goes from a desert planet to a sort of oasis planet. And there's also an entire religious component of it that I'm not going to go into, which has to do with the Bene Gesserit religion, which is also, it becomes a prevalent part of the book for why he's accepted into the Fremen society.
Matt, remember the beginning of this conversation when you couldn't remember the plot line of Maniac McGee at all? And you said,
right.
And then some other book you couldn't remember. And think now about Dune and how deep you're in. This is amazing.
Well, I think
it's very impressive.
Maybe it's meant a lot more to me than Maniac McGee. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, where are you in Dune? Like, what does this book mean to you?
I thought it was a fantastic story. Like, I was just really engrossed in the story in general. But I also did, as I said, I read it as a story about a native people on a planet being completely exploited in really cruel and terrible ways to extract a resource from that planet and take advantage of those, you know, the natives of the planet. And I think, you know, given world history, there's so many examples of that. And I think I made the connection to oil specifically. I think there, for several reasons, it was, you know, the spice in the book is the thing that enables them to travel in their ships from place to place. So there's the resource from the desert planet as the thing that enables this kind of travel, which I think, you know, was one connection.
I mean, something that I'm wondering, listening to you talk about how passionate you are about this book. I mean, you're lighting up talking about this book is, you know, this is really, it sounds like a book that reflects a lot of the skepticism and a lot of the dark inequalities that you're thinking about on Earth. And I'm wondering, you know, in human politics, you're reading about counterculture stuff, you're reading about transcendental stuff, which in large part is a rejection of a certain capitalistic society. Like, does reading science fiction that in some ways confirms your fears about Earth and human behavior, is that in some way comforting to you to read about an alternate world in which, you know, maybe there's oil, people are fighting wars about oil? Is that somehow comforting to you to read that? Or what are you getting out of this reading experience?
I don't know if comforting is the right word. I definitely find some deeper sense of meaning in it. I think than just what goes on in our day-to-day world. You know, the fact that somebody is able to take a situation that they may presumably have found troubling and then make such a beautiful story out of it, to sort of shape that into something that can be considered, you know, a work of art or this wonderful creative expression that people could then, you know, maybe some other people could read and bring it back and project their understanding of what the author's meaning was back onto the world. And I think that's kind of an incredible effect that some of these things have. And I think some science fiction can be very aspirational. And then some of it can also be very, you know, can provide important social critiques and sort of, you know, create some great political allegories, to a lot of contemporary problems or problems that we've seen throughout history that seem to repeat themselves. So I've always been fascinated by that element. Absolutely. Like the connection back to, the human condition and, you know, our history and our politics and things like that. I've always been really engaged by that. So.
So when you're reading this stuff, are you reading Dune when you're in college or?
I reread it after undergrad. I went back and revisited Dune and loved it just as much. going back and reading it again. And it still carried kind of the same resonance that it. The second time around that it did when I read it in high school. So.
I'm wondering if any of the things that you read when you were in high school or college in any way informed what you wanted to do with your life. Because it seems like you were a very self-conscious reader. You're reading things that are about ideas and ways of thinking about the world and your place within it. So, I mean, are you consciously reading things and it's informing the choices that you're making? Or do you see that in hindsight?
I think I always gravitated toward that sort of thing. Like it was just, I was really interested in it. I really enjoyed reading stuff like that and got things out of it. And so there was always this kind of interesting pairing of that though, with like, when I was young, I also loved like Mad Magazine and you know, things that were just like not things that were the complete opposite of the sort of level of attention and depth that you would get out of some of these stories. I also enjoyed like the really simplistic satirical, and not even necessarily simplistic, but the really like satirical very topical kind of things too. So, but yeah, I don't know. I'd never really thought about it like that, actually. Like, why, what attracted me to those things outside of just, I really liked them. I always found the subject matters fascinating, or found their connections to the world that we live in to be very interesting, sometimes troubling, sometimes inspiring.
When you were in college, did you have time to read for fun, or were you just mainly reading the books that were, what did you study in college?
As an undergrad, I majored in print journalism, and then in graduate school, I got a master's in urban and regional policy and urban informatics, which is just like a data nerd policy stuff. It's like a bunch of number crunching and things for urban policy issues. I think that sort of attraction to the meaning in some of these books, or the underlying issues in a lot of these books, and that kind of thinking probably did influence my decision to focus on journalism as an undergrad, and then, you know, pursue the course in, as a master's that I did. So I've always been kind of a policy wonk and really into that stuff too. So
Fair enough. We certainly need people who are into that kind of thing, so that's a good thing.
One quick thing on that topic of science fiction and policy wonk. I will say one really troubling trend that's emerged in the mainstream political sphere over the past several. I don't know. Like, I guess I first started noticing it seeming to be really prevalent, like, maybe 8 years ago or so, but is like the obsession with Ayn Rand that people have, and, you know, like members of Congress talk about it like it's this, you know, this guiding light for them, and I'm kind of like, what?
Yeah, what do you make of that? Have you read Ayn Rand, or what do you make of that?
Yeah, I have. I read it in Atlas Shrugged in high school. And then I've read some of her essays too. And I personally don't agree with anything about her philosophy or her politics or anything like that. But even, you know, I would say I always read her stuff as works of fiction, apart from the essays, like her books, or the books she's best known for. You know, I read them generally as works of fiction that are kind of, I don't know, it's not something that I think should be informing an entire political philosophy that has such a prevalent role now.
Yeah, why do you think it's having such a heyday right now?
I think the gist of her ideals and philosophy appeals to that strain of conservatism, or that sort of really, really believes in like self-interest, and that, you know, that it's just like, you know, if everybody works as hard as they possibly can, there's no reason why anyone can't succeed, and everyone is totally responsible for their own destiny, and that, you know, anything that anyone who isn't successful, or that anything that is not, you know, anyone who needs help, it's their fault. You know, it's this sort of cold, I think she called it an objectivism. I think it belongs in fiction. Like, it's not something that should have been translated into a real actual political philosophy.
Yeah.
So
if you were a congressperson, instead of reading from Atlas Shrugged on the floors of the Senate or the House, what book would you be reading from?
Oh, that's a great question. Don't know. That's a really good question. So I guess you would have to, I mean, if, I don't know if I could pick one.
You can have more than one.
Okay. I guess I would want to pick books that in some way sort of captured or illustrated a hope for the direction that things go. And so in that case, it might be, I don't know, that's great. Maybe it's not, it veers away from fiction and more into philosophy, but maybe something like Bertrand Russell, if we're talking about people who's, but oh, Ursula Le Guin would be a great one. That just popped into my mind. As in terms of a writer, a science fiction writer whose books have a much deeper meaning than just the plot itself and really speak to a deeper sense of humanity, I think.
So give me an example. Yeah, which one would you pick?
For Ursula Le Guin books, you mean?
Yeah.
I would probably... Of the ones I've read, The Dispossessed is my favorite. But I also, I recently read The Word for World is Forest. Have you read that one? Or are you familiar?
No, I have not.
Have you seen the movie Avatar? Because
yes,
I think James Cameron basically took the plot of Word for World is Forest and just translated it into his idea for a movie. But it's kind of a, about that sort of this idea of a I guess similar to Dune, it's about a planet being exploited for its resources or exploratory purposes, and the sort of conquerors, so to speak, just completely disregarding the planet itself, how the planet functions, any of the any of the natural ecological systems on the planet and the way that they just come in and run like roughshod over it to maximize the output that they can get from it. So I guess as a sort of metaphor, maybe that would be a book that I pointed to. It would be, that's a really good question. You should use that in other podcasts too. I think that would be a really good one, but would be a good one to have some time to think on too.
All right. Well, if you think of another one, you can let me know.
Okay.
Okay. So what are you reading these days? What are you up to now as a reader? Where has your life as a reader taken you?
Right now, I'm finishing a trilogy by William Gibson called The Bridge Trilogy. And William, are you familiar with William Gibson at all?
No.
He's probably best known for Neuromancer, and people sort of credit him as being the originator of the sort of cyberpunk literary genre. I don't know how much he considers himself to be that, but he writes a lot about the integration of technology and networked communications into people, but in a very fantastic sort of way. But he was doing this long before the internet was like the internet as we know it today. Anyway, I'm finishing up a trilogy by him called The Bridge Trilogy that follows sort of several story arcs of multiple characters across. It's based on this place that's generally just referred to as the Bridge, but I think you can understand it as the I think it's the Golden Gate Bridge. But it's after a large earthquake has happened and the bridge it was abandoned because it was no longer structurally viable, and so people just colonized it, and it turned into this entirely egalitarian, strange place that has evolved into its own world. And it's sort of the three stories in the trilogy are centered around that. But there's a lot that goes from that. So yeah, that's what I'm doing. And then I think after I'm done with that trilogy, I might take a break from the sci-fi stuff for a little while. but I'm not, I'm not sure what I would read after that. I did buy a book recently called Trekonomics. That's it's a serious investigation of how the economics of the Star Trek universe would actually work, like what that would look like, how that would
look. It doesn't have to be serious. You don't have to defend yourself. Again, this is a safe space. It's fine. Don't cover your face. Yeah. Everything is fine. Yeah.
I think I might go with that one next.
Is Star Trek a big interest of yours?
Yes, but only really Next Generation and Deep Space Nine are the two that I really love. Those are my two favorites. But yeah, Star Trek is definitely.
Is reading about it does something different for you than watching it?
I was never as into the books. I never really got that into the Star Trek books, and the Trekonomics book is actually more of a serious look at economics in the show and in the Star Trek universe, and how that would actually work, like how I think the modern world would have to change to facilitate the sort of economy that is implied in the Star Trek universe, at least in the Federation, because depending on where they are, there are different economic systems. But
of course,
yeah.
Do you ever connect with other people, or do you do research online about Star Trek? I mean, because Star Trek has such a huge community online.
It does. Not really. I feel pretty lucky to have a coworker who's really into the Star Trek universe also. So we talk about it, and I don't take for granted the fact that I have somebody who can get the reference, like we can make references just in passing, and you know, we'll get the references. So that's kind of fun. But I don't really like seek it out in terms of online communities. I've never been to a Star Trek convention or anything like that, but it's not that I wouldn't go. I just haven't been. I don't really take fandom to that level.
I guess I was just curious because, you know, it's interesting to think about the internet as its own genre of reading. So as opposed to, you know, sitting down with a hard copy book or reading a particular genre like sci-fi or like transcendentalists, to read the internet, is that a different kind of reading experience for you? Do you lose sense of track of time in a different way than you do when you're reading a book if you're in a rabbit hole online?
Yeah, I think so. And that happens to me anyway, in kind of two different ways. One is just the difference between reading something from a screen and then reading something from a book, like just the tactile sensation sort of. And that I find that it's easier for me to get engaged for long periods of time in books than it is on a screen. Like I don't have a Kindle and I don't read on an iPad because I just don't, it's harder for me to like continuously do that. And I'm not sure why, cause I stare at screens all day for work and everything. But, and then it's also, I think generally when reading things online and taking in information online, it's a lot more, incremental. It's like a lot more fragmented, you know, like you're taking in a lot of different sources. You may have a browser open like 10 different tabs and you're going from each one constantly like looking at things, and then somebody sends you a chat or, you know, there's just so much more. And I think for having done that for such a long time, like I think it's sort of conditioned my brain to think that way when I'm in front of a computer screen usually. So it's not the same type of concentration reading from a screen that I get reading from a book.
Interesting. So by way of closing, what's a book you would recommend to our listeners? If you could, not to up the stakes from though, if you could give one book, read one book to Congress, if you could give one book to our listeners, what book would you be giving all of us?
Let's see. I'm going to turn around and look at my bookshelf for just a second.
Go for it.
Okay. Again, choosing one is just so difficult. All right, so maybe it might be The Pale Blue Dot, a book by Carl Sagan, and only because it's a book I can think of that captures so much of just everything that is, you know, and explains it in such a beautiful way. Because there are so many books with wonderful plots that I would love for people to read and have conversations about, but I really don't think I could pick one to stand out as my favorite. So in terms of a book that just overall I think would be really meaningful and has just incorporates a lot of the optimism, I guess, that you hope for, and a lot of the ways of understanding things and looking at things, it would probably be the book Pale Blue Dot, but I should have thought about that. I should have seen that question coming and thought about that a little more too.
Don't worry. No pressure. Well, this has been a delightful conversation. Is there any other books I've missed that you want to get into?
Not really. I mean, I could go into any number of things, but no, not really. I don't think so. Nothing that comes to mind. If I need to send any kind of like follow up or footnotes, I'll email you and say, oh, I forgot to mention this. But
well, I'm actually really happy you said that, because I can tell you and our listeners that we have this thing on our blog called Endnotes. I don't know if you've checked out our blog, but on Endnotes, the guests on this show, after we talk, if something comes into their mind and they think, oh, geez, I really forgot this book that was so important to me, or you know, I was wrong about this thing, or I've thought about this whole other unrelated thing. People have written blog posts for the blog called Endnotes, where the guests get the last word. And so if something should come to your mind, you can write a little post about, you know, this is the book I would give to Congress, or this is the book I would want everyone to read. Now that I've had a chance to think about it, and Mary has stopped pestering me, in person, but you know, it is a place too for our listeners who are curious to check it out, where guests have written a lot of really interesting things, either about the systems they've developed to record their reading history, or for people to think about books that oddly their own personal life has mirrored the plot of the book that they've just stumbled upon. A novel was one of our most recent ones. So it's a really cool space for people on this show to kind of get in touch with guests on this show, and for guests to reflect on their experiences.
That sounds great. And just to clarify, I meant no offense to anybody who likes Dragons and Swords. So just putting that out there. If that's your thing, that's wonderful. And I don't, you know, certainly didn't mean to.
It's okay. I don't think you're going to take any offense. I wouldn't worry about it. Yeah. I wouldn't make your end note about an apology. I think there's other things you can say.
Sure. So this has been great. Thank you very much for the chance to talk to you and be on your show.
Thank you. It's been wonderful. Thanks. I'd like to thank our guest, Matt, for sharing his story with us. I'd also like to thank our technical director, Taylor, for all her help. You can follow us on Instagram at ChaptersPod. There you'll find Shelby's submitted by our guests. You can find us on Twitter at ChaptersPod. You can find me at MaryMahoney123 and Taylor at MJTThePhD. Visit our website, www.chapterspod.com, if you'd like to share your story on Chapters. You can also find links to every book mentioned on this and every episode on our website. If you enjoy our show, please rate and review us in the iTunes store. It really helps listeners find our show. Thanks for listening.